Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The value of the cryptocurrency Bitcoin hit a new high over the weekend, and it continues to rise. The recent surge has created the world's first Bitcoin billionaires, the twins Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, perhaps best known as early investors in Facebook. The price for one Bitcoin has more than doubled in the past 2 months, trading at over $11,800 at some points this morning. Joining us now to discuss Bitcoin's volatility is tech reporter for Quartz, June Ian Wong. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Thanks. How practical is Bitcoin as an actual currency these days?
Probably less practical than many other currencies. Not that many merchants accept Bitcoin as a method of payment, although many actually do. So, for example, you know, Microsoft accepts Bitcoin in its online digital store. And a company called BitPay, which specializes in Bitcoin payments for companies, reports, you know, ever-growing transaction volumes processing Bitcoins for merchants. So, you know, not that many places, but a growing number of people accept Bitcoin.
And I guess investors anticipate that that number will grow over time.
Yeah, that's one of the premises behind you know, investing in Bitcoin is the idea that, you know, eventually it will be widely accepted as a form of payment.
What are the other premises for this increased value?
Well, one of the properties of Bitcoin that attracted many early investors was this idea that it's trustless or censorship resistant. And so what that means is essentially it's very difficult to shut it down. It's very difficult for any single party to shut it down. And that's because it's not backed or it's not issued by any single party. So this decentralization of the currency is what attracted most people to it in the early days. And it, you know, continues to be one of the main things that sets it apart from, you know, fiat-issued currencies.
But with fiat-issued currencies, there is a certain amount of stability, or not necessarily?
I think it really depends on the issuer, right? So, of course, some people would argue that the U.S. dollar is not necessarily a good example of a fiat currency. And then you might look at places like Venezuela, for instance, where the Bolivar has lost almost all its value in recent years. So it really depends on the issuer. And I think Bitcoin's argument is that, like, look, here's another option. Here's a thing that's not correlated to fiat currency that you could adopt and store your wealth in.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're limited in what other places you can do it.
Right, absolutely.
You wrote that venture capital firms are taking Bitcoin seriously.
Yes, and they have been for a while. And the way that they've been engaging with Bitcoin as an asset class has also changed over the years. So, you know, in kind of the early days, 2012, 2013, they were investing in startups that dealt with Bitcoin. So, you know, these are companies like BitPay, companies like Coinbase, which provide a wallet and an exchange service. Over the years, they have started to invest directly in cryptocurrencies themselves. So, or in funds, hedge funds that invest in cryptocurrencies. So they've actually, you know, kind of shifted their exposure. They're now more directly exposed to the asset class than in the early days.
People who already own Bitcoin have a vested interest in attracting others to the fold, right? How does that play out? Why is that?
Sure. I mean, this is one of the big criticisms of Bitcoin is that, you know, it has this Ponzi scheme or pyramid scheme-like dynamic. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that, you know, there's a limited supply of Bitcoin. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin produced. We're currently at about 16.7 million that have already been produced. And because it's deflationary like that, there's a hard limit. The more demand there is for the Bitcoin, because it's a set limit, the higher the price goes. You know, it's a simple
supply and demand, right?
Yeah. Equation. Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing that, you know, if I get 10 people to buy Bitcoin and I already have Bitcoin, then, you know, in theory, the price of Bitcoin should continue to go up.
Is that what's behind those late night commercials about, you know, or those different kinds of commercials that hype investing in Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, these kind of very eye-catching returns. Like this year, it is, you know, it's returned, I think, 10,000%. So huge returns, and I think that attracts a certain type of a marketer or a certain type of company that wants to try and capitalize on those eye-popping numbers and suggest that, you know, you too can benefit from this incredibly volatile asset.
It's often forgotten that Bitcoin is not the only game in town. There are other cryptocurrencies out there. Something called the initial coin offering market or ICO market might be playing a role in Bitcoin's astronomical price. What are the competitors?
Sure. So, there are hundreds of cryptocurrencies out there. Among them are names like Ethereum. Ethereum has a $45 billion market value. Other names are Ripple, which has a $10 billion market value, Litecoin, $5.5 billion. So there's a whole array of them. And, you know, some of them have features that are similar to Bitcoin and others are quite different. So Ethereum, for instance, allows you to do not just transactions on its blockchain, but also computation. And, you know, Ethereum's pitch is that we can decentralize computing in the same way that Bitcoin decentralized money. So there's a whole plethora of cryptocurrencies out there. The initial coin offering phenomenon is a specific class of digital tokens that are generally issued on top of the Ethereum blockchain. There have been very, very successful ones over the summer where people have raised hundreds of millions of dollars in a matter of minutes or hours.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Bitcoins. They've had a great few days. But some say the investment is a bubble. And compare it to the 17th century tulip bulb boom. My guest is June Ian Wong. He's a tech reporter from Quartz. If you have a question or comment about Bitcoin, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, June, what about that warning that this is a bubble and it's going to explode? And what would matter in that case?
Sure. I think even the most ardent Bitcoin believers would not deny that the current price levels are overbought, that it's really high. So I think even the most ardent Bitcoin believers would agree and accept that, you know, currently it is a bubble. Mm-hmm. Whether it crashes, I think it's a matter of time. The last big bubble was in 2013, 2014, when it ran up from about under $100 to $1,300. And that one crashed because it turned out that there was a massive fraud in the biggest Bitcoin exchange at the time, something called Mt. Gox that was based in Tokyo. All sorts of things could trigger a crash, but it's not clear at the moment what will trigger a crash in this current run-up.
How do folks like Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss cash out? I mean, it seems to me if it is approaching a bubble and it's going to burst, which, you know, everything what goes up must come down. It's pretty classic. How do they cash out of this?
Sure. So, you know, they themselves operate an exchange, so they could presumably cash out through their own company. But, you know, there are huge Bitcoin exchanges out there. They allow people to trade fiat currency dollars for cryptocurrencies. And so that would be one way, essentially, of doing it, selling to an exchange. Big holders of Bitcoin also often do over-the-counter trades. And companies, trading firms like DRW in Chicago, one of the world's biggest commodities traders, they have a Bitcoin OTC trading desk, which allows you to trade millions of dollars worth of cryptocurrency. So they are those would be the channels that, you know, big holders would use.
You referred to it a few minutes ago. The blockchain, cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin are based on such a thing as a blockchain. Can you refresh our memories on what that is and why it's so important for cryptocurrency?
Sure. So you can think of a blockchain as kind of the product of using a cryptocurrency. In the case of Bitcoin, its blockchain is essentially a record of all the transactions that have ever been made by anyone, from the very first Bitcoin transaction ever to the current, to the latest transaction. So it's literally a list of all transactions that have been made, who has sent how much Bitcoin to whom, and this is recorded on a immutable ledger, which is distributed across the world, across thousands or tens of thousands of computers, on an open source software, mm-hmm. and it's called a blockchain.
So it's not exactly a public record, but it's available to all?
Yes. I mean, it is a public record in the sense that you can, you know, go to a what's called a block explorer. These are third-party websites that allow you to browse the blockchain. You can go to a block explorer. You can enter, you know, a Bitcoin wallet address. You can enter a transaction ID, and it will show you when it was done, how much was transacted, and to which addresses were involved in that transaction.
But say law enforcement wants to track these things to show a connection between, you know, the dark web and some vendor on the dark web selling, you know, human trafficking or whatever. That's not because everyone's technically anonymous, right?
Right. So in Bitcoin, you're pseudonymous. Meaning that, you know, you have unique identities, but they are not necessarily linked to some real-world identity. Mm-hmm. And so law enforcement actually quite likes Bitcoin. You know, we've seen in previous cases, like the Silk Road case, where they were able to, having gained access to the Silk Road operator's computer, they could then look up blockchain Bitcoin transactions on the blockchain and link those funds to the Silk Road operator.
Without them knowing it.
Right. I think at that point they already had access to his computer.
Okay.
And I think they had him in custody at that point. But, you know, essentially because the blockchain is permanent and immutable, mm-hmm. you can go back, you know, after the fact, you can go back and you can link those transactions back and show how the funds went from, you know, for instance, some vendor on the dark web to a operator of the dark web.
You recently wrote about U.S. regulators giving the green light to trade Bitcoin futures. What went into their, you know, how much was this considered, and you know, what's the significance of that?
Mm-hmm. So the futures market is a big step forward for Bitcoin trading. It allows institutional traders to get on the action because it gives them a tool to hedge their risk, to short Bitcoin, and to speculate about the price of Bitcoin in the future, which is a common tool used in other commodities and equity markets.
Meaning they can bet on it going down as well as up.
Absolutely, right. Yes. And so having that instrument means that you could have a large number of institutional traders with a lot more money coming into the Bitcoin market because now they feel that they can hedge their risk better.
Can you paint a picture of what the ideal scenario is for cryptocurrency if it's widely adopted? Would it have to be one cryptocurrency, or is this something where you could have multiples and still have an ideal situation?
Sure. I think, you know, the original vision for Bitcoin called for essentially Bitcoin to be a kind of replacement for fiat currencies. But I think the situation, and that, you know, Bitcoin's about 9 years old, so about a decade ago. But I think as it has developed, I think what we've seen is that there has been a proliferation, a diversity of different types of cryptocurrencies, each of them performing a slightly different function. So I suspect as we go forward, we're going to have a situation with a plurality of cryptocurrencies that will coexist and complement fiat currencies and legacy payment systems in various ways.
I wanted to read an email right now. And it says that Bitcoin has the capacity to drain trillions out of the real world economy, similar in fashion to the way technology companies with a tax revenue tracking system drain cities of millions. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I can see the similarities. I mean, you could, you know, one argument against Bitcoin adoption is that it's essentially a tool to launder money, right? So you can use it as a way to keep your wealth offshore. Mm-hmm. In this case, offshore being in Bitcoin or in other cryptocurrencies. So I can see that being, I can see the similarities there. However, you know, the total value of all cryptocurrencies at the moment is only about $360 billion. So not massive, and certainly quite difficult if the world's kind of billionaires and so on and corporations want to start stashing their money in cryptocurrencies. So it's at the moment not that attractive compared to, I think, legacy money laundering and offshoring methods.
June Ian Wong, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's June Ian Wong. He's a tech reporter from Quartz. We'll continue Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. If there is one thing that social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter are good at, it's capturing our attention. More than 2 billion social media users social media users across the globe are paying attention. And according to some estimates, the average person will spend nearly 2 hours on social media every day. But the power of social media can have serious consequences, helping misinformation spread, reinforcing our ideological bubbles, and potentially influencing the outcome of elections. Journalist and author Guy Harrison tackles the pitfalls of social media in his new book. It's entitled Think Before You Like: Social Media's Effect on the Brain and the Tools You Need to Navigate Your News Feed. Guy Harrison joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about social media's effect on the brain?
Wow. Well, we're still learning. I mean, the experiment is being run as we speak, and we're all part of it. It's amazing what's going on. You know, it's important that people understand that we are way, way past the point of being able to, you know, just dismiss social media as some sort of Kardashian money-making device or a cat video delivery system. You know, now it's a serious thing. More and more people get their news from social media. They're connecting with people. And what's really scary is that all the vulnerabilities, all the very human problems that we have with subconscious biases, all our tendencies to trip ourselves up by sloppy thinking, all that is being played out in the social media ecosystem. And it's really causing a lot of problems, you know, not just with the recent election and all that, but there's so much going on. And my book is simply, it's not a condemnation of social media. It's just a call for people to kind of wake up and realize what's going on, be aware of privacy issues, and most importantly, be really sharp about thinking online. You know, make sure that you're second guessing yourself, you're analyzing, you're kind of thinking like a scientist at all times. That is absolutely crucial.
Because unlike, say, reading the newspaper or watching the nightly news, like many of us grew up doing, there is not a passive pastime.
Yeah, social media is great. You know, there's so many good things about it, and it's also horrible. There's so many bad things about it. And that's what people need to, you know, keep clear in their mind at all times. It's wonderful. Use it. Take advantage of it. Have fun with it, all that. Make connections, all that. But you have got to always, always be aware that about 99% of your mental activity is subconscious. It's occurring behind that curtain of consciousness. You know, there's all sorts of things like the mere exposure effect. You know, you can be impacted by something even if at the in the moment, this is perfect for social media, if you see something and you think, oh, well, that's ridiculous, who would believe that? Well, guess what? You've just been exposed to that crazy idea, crazy news story. And then 48 hours later, a week later, a month later, if you encounter it again, because of the way the human mind works, you're more likely to believe it. And you won't even remember seeing it that first time. You know, little things like that. There's many of them. The anchoring effect. You know, your mind will always seek to help you out in a situation to figure things out, even if it means latching on to completely irrelevant or wrong information. It will feed it to you in the hopes that it can help you get through the moment.
It sounds so like sounds like a virus or something.
Yeah, well, no, it's part of being human. I mean, that's how we work. And it's okay. I mean, most of the time, all these little mental quirks work well for us. You know, they've kept us alive for, you know, 2 million years. The genus, the Homo genus, has thrived for 2 million years, in large part because of the way our minds work. But we're living in this super complex, high-tech world now, so we got to be sharp. You got to second-guess yourself. You got to ask for evidence. You got to seek out the source. You got to verify. You got to do a little bit of homework. Otherwise, you're just going to stumble through life as a constant victim, especially on social media.
You've written about something called the Dunning-Kruger effect in the brain. What is it, and how does it come into play with social media?
Yeah, that's huge. The Dunning-Kruger effect affects us all, you know, in the real world or online. I mean, it's always a big problem, because basically what it is, it's that we don't know what we don't know. We don't realize we're very bad. We as humans, regardless of intelligence or education, we're very bad at being able to accurately judge our own incompetence, our own ignorance of things we're not familiar with. And that makes sense, but what it does is it leads us to be more confident than we should be about things we know nothing about. You know, for example, I know a lot about prehistoric humans. You know, I've studied anthropology and all this stuff. So if you have a discussion with me about Neanderthals or Homo erectus or something, I'm going to constantly phrase my language in, you know, as far as we know, according to the evidence, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I'm going to avoid absolute declarations because I know there's a lot I don't know, a lot that's not known at all. The evidence isn't there yet. But say, just a layperson who's never done any sort of studying about prehistoric humans, you ask them their opinion on Neanderthals because of the Dunning-Kruger effect, they're likely to just ramble on for an hour about all the things, you know, they think they're some sort of amateur expert on, because they don't know what they don't know. Hmm. And that happens a lot on social media because, you know, your buddy passes over this news article about something, you don't know anything about, you know, the Asian car trade at the moment, how it's looking in the forecast for the next 20 years. You have no idea about that. But you read the story about it and you think, oh, that makes sense. And then, you know, you start filling in the blanks and suddenly you're some sort of economic expert on car exports in Asia or something. But the problem is you don't realize how ignorant you are. And that trips people up all the time. Big part of being a good critical thinker is humility. That is crucial.
Yeah, but that's always been the case.
Well, it's all. There's always been the need. I don't know how well we have been as a species. Being on guard for this stuff. And listen, that's another thing. To defend social media for a moment, there has always been fake news. There's always been propaganda. There's mm-hmm. always been manipulation by corporations and governments and creepy people. That stuff has always been going on. It's just, it's never been quite so immediate and right there in your face, in your home, the way it is now, 24 hours a day. You know, and another thing is crucial and absolutely, absolutely important. I really cover this well in the book, is that people got to understand that there's some hardworking people out there with a lot of resources, a lot of time and money, a lot of manpower, labor. They're working hard to figure out how to keep you stuck on these social media platforms, mm. and they are just sucking up your private data, everything about you. You know, most people, it's shocking to me, but still in 2017, most people still don't realize that these social media platforms exist not primarily for some grand vision to unite us all so we'll all live happily ever after. They're there free so that they can harvest our private data, which can then be sold to marketers and can be used for precision advertising, which is extremely important. Some people call personal data the new oil. I mean, mm-hmm. it is a lucrative, you know, business. to get this stuff. All these apps that people get for free, they're spies, almost every one of them.
Well,
what, the reason they're free is they're making money off you.
Right. So what's so great about this then? You say, hey, it's fabulous, it's wonderful. It doesn't sound really wonderful when you're talking about it in terms of harvesting our private data.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of gross, but...
Yeah, sounds like a good sci-fi movie.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but as I point out in my book, Think Before You Like, I make it very clear that, you know, social media has a lot of problems, many challenges, things that people must be aware of to avoid being just, constant victims, like I said. But I'm absolutely fair about this because I really do believe social media is great. There's so many good things about it. It connects people, long-lost friends. People make new friends all the time. And one of the biggest problems we have in our modern, high-tech, concrete jungle society is that many of us lack sufficient intimate connections in our lives with other human beings. You know, the hunter-gatherer days are long gone. We don't bond the way we used to with a tight group of people. You know, most of us anyway don't have that luxury. We're moving too fast and, you know, everybody's staying out of everybody's way and all this stuff. Social media kind of, sort of, a little bit, not completely, obviously, but it helps with this, I think. And the potential is there for it to really help us out a lot more in the future. It really can do good things. And, you know, there's fundraisers for people in need that happen on social media, things that really just never happened to this degree ever before. So you know, I'm kind of torn in a way. I mean, I see the dark side, and I see the real great potential of social media. And my answer to it is just, hey, get the information and be aware so you can be one of the smart ones out there and you can protect yourself and use it wisely.
What does science tell us about how all this time we spend on social media is affecting our mood? Now, somebody might be playing a game of bubbles, or they might be on Words with Friends, or they might be playing some other kind of computer game on their phone. Everybody knows it's our pocket computers. But a lot of people focus their attention on social media. Is there a difference?
Yes, there is. There is. Social media, in the general sense, there's that good thing underlying there somewhere of connection with another human being, which is absolutely vital to us. We are social creatures. We're primates. We've got to have other people in our lives. We hurt one another. You know, the worst thing you can do to a prisoner, it's not beat him up. It's not give him bad food. It's isolate him. That is the worst punishment. You know, we die without other people. So, yeah, social media's got that going for it. Just simply playing a game by yourself, staring at a screen for 10 hours a day, I don't think that's good. And I've got a whole chapter on addiction and overuse and that kind of stuff. And, and the whole addiction thing, it's even controversial. I mean, it's so new. And clearly, many people do spend too much time on social media or the internet in general to the point where they're harming their lives. Other people spend twice that amount of time of that person, and yet their lives are great. So it's a very, not subjective, but it's a very individual kind of thing. You know, it's not, there's not a set amount of hours per day that everyone should, you know, hold to. I mean, it really does depend on the person, the situation, the lifestyle, the personality, all of that, what they're actually doing. But, make no mistake about it, this is a big change for humans. I mean, people are now spending, listen to this, people are now spending, on average, more time on social media, at a higher rate of time on social media per day, than they will spend eating, you know, grooming themselves, socializing in person with other people over their lifetime. You know, if you take a whole lifetime of somebody just born today, at the end of it, if they're a mid to high social media user, you add up all the time they spent on eating, actually having conversations with other human beings in their face, and then social media time wins. You know, that's amazing. I mean, Americans...
And we don't know how it's going to change us going forward yet.
Yeah, well, we know it's messing up some people. I mean, there's clinics, you know, in South Korea, China, they've got hospitals, you know, beds filled up with people whose lives have apparently just fallen apart because they couldn't walk away from the screen. You know, they couldn't stop it. You know, and right now, I mean, you know, a typical American, 18 to 24 years old, checks their phone 82 times a day, you know, on average. Collectively, Americans are looking at those smartphone screens gosh, what is it? I think it's 8 billion times per day. I mean, it's incredible. You know, and listen, this is very disturbing. I think it was about 40% of girls, what was it, something like 18 to 30, I think, young women, 18 to 30, identify themselves as Facebook addicts. I mean, some of those are probably just saying it in a lighthearted way, maybe, but still, mm-hmm. that's pretty high. I mean, 40%, wow. You know, clearly within that 40%, there's some people who are in some way suffering, they feel, from their use of Facebook. And so there are problems here, and parents need to put controls, you know, help children, just like you did with the TV or something, you know, put some guidelines, some boundaries, you know, teach responsibility. The ideal, what I've always strived for as a parent, is not to be some brutal prison guard, mm-hmm. but to teach my children how to control themselves. You know, that's the goal, and for adults as well. It's not just children.
The age of social media has introduced us to the acronym TLDR, which stands for Too Long Didn't Read. I'm glad I know that now. What do we know about social media impact on attention spans? Sometimes, though, when it's too long didn't read, it's because I don't care that much about what someone wrote. It's something they're kind of exploding on the screen, but I who has time to do all that reading?
Yeah, or you mean as far as like social media posts and all
yeah,
that stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, that's the, you know, for some people, that's their day. They'll spend hours and hours scrolling through those Twitter feeds and all that. And, you know, I mean, it depends. If you, you know, hey, Ann, maybe you need more exciting friends in your little network. I don't know. But you know, but yeah, but no, you touch on something very important, because I didn't only interview experts for this book. I interviewed regular social media users. And I was really saddened by a few who said that they just don't read books like they used to. More than I think it was about probably three or four said that they feel they can't read a good novel in the way they used to. Something has happened to their attention span, their ability mm-hmm. to just slow down and get lost in a book, you mm-hmm. know, and that's disturbing. I mean, I would assume that ability would come back rather quickly if you just kind of lessen or eliminate all that social media stuff. But yeah, social media, one quick thing, and it's really important for people to understand, these platforms are designed to hook you and keep you coming back. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that, you know, I liken them to slot machines, you know, and mm-hmm. in fact, some of the same experts who designed slot machines in Vegas have helped, have consulted, have worked on these social media platforms, you know. So all these little things that you see on the screen, you know, the likes and the thumbs up mm-hmm. and the little heart and all these things, it seems silly and you think, oh, it wouldn't work on me. But hey, remember what I said earlier, 99% of your mental activity is happening in the dark. You're not really aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so these things work. It's proven. And they've got this ability to run constant experiments, one after the other, all the time, on hundreds of millions of people, so they can find out what works, what doesn't, mm-hmm. and they can just keep doing it. And that's really disturbing, you know, that, because, I mean, we don't want to be just a species of zombies stumbling around, staring down at phones all day with no real, you know, nothing really of value produced in the end. I mean, that's not good.
Mm-hmm. Guy Harrison, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, Ann, thank you so much. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Guy Harrison, a journalist and author, his new book is entitled Think Before You Like, Social Media's Effect on the Brain and the Tools You Need to Navigate Your Newsfeed. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Every year we ask Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley to share his favorite tech gift ideas. Last week we covered gifts for kids. You can hear that segment by visiting WOSU.org/allsides. Today we're talking about gadget gifts for adults. Russell joins us by phone. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
The first gift idea on your list is the Google Home Mini. There are a lot of smart speakers out there. Why are you recommending the Google Home Mini?
Well, two reasons in particular. One, this one is tied into Google's Assistant, which has, you know, over the last year demonstrated the most, you know, growth as far as features and things that it can connect to and, you know, services that it has access to. So if you're not, you know, really as sold on the idea of getting a smart speaker as you would be to spend maybe $130 or $150 on like the big Amazon Echo or the big Google Home. The Google Home Mini, you know, in most places is on sale for $30 for the Christmas season. So it's hard to go wrong as a trial.
What does it look like and how does it sound?
It looks like a little donut.
Okay.
And that's actually Google's description of it. it comes in a couple different colors, and it actually sounds pretty good for its size. You know, it is a smaller speaker. It doesn't have the ability to connect to larger speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot, its direct competitor. But on its own, you know, it's enough to fill my living room with sounds, you know, that would be, you know, matching quality to what would come from my television.
Wow. Can you go over some of the ways you can use Google Home and how it compares and contrasts with, you know, Echo and the rest of
them? Sure, yeah. I mean, the biggest thing that you can do with this thing is you know, access any of the things that you would normally access from your phone. You know, so this has a lot of things that will tie into directly things that are on your phone based on your voice. So you teach it your voice, it links that to your account. And so when you say things like, call someone, you know, if you want to, you know, you can actually use it as a phone and it searches your contacts to make those phone calls. If you ask for, to search for something or to add something to your to-do list or something like that, it actually adds to your specific account. And if you have other people in the house who have also trained their voice to the service, then it will very easily tell the difference between the two of them. It also connects to all kinds of, smart lighting and any kind of connected home thermostats or smart locks or anything like that, and makes it all some, you know, things that you can control very easily with your voice.
So you said it's about $30.
In most places, yeah, you'll find it on sale for $30. They're normally $50, but in most places, you'll see them on sale through Christmas for that discounted price.
All right. Your pick for headphones are the Mod 1 modular headphones. What does it mean for headphones to be modular?
Well, in this case, it's actually just a little bit of flexibility when it comes to how you go to use it. Something I deeply appreciate about these phones is headphones is that they are both wired and wireless, and they work very well in both situations. You can connect if you have a phone with a headphone jack, and those are slowly disappearing. But you can connect if you have that ability. If, you know, something happens to the headphones, a lot of the pieces on the headphones themselves are replaceable, like the ear pads, which frequently wear out on headphones that I wear. One weird feature that these have is that they can actually charge while you're using them, which is strangely uncommon for a lot of wireless headphones. Is the ability to charge while you're using them. So if you are like me and sit at a desk for probably an unhealthy amount of time each day, and you know, kind of roaming around your office wirelessly, when you sit down, you can actually charge them and still be able to listen to music.
And that happens because you can plug them in or what?
Right. Yeah. There's a you know, you can plug them in while they're charging and be able to listen to whatever is going on.
Okay. All right.
And they also sound really nice. I guess that's probably an important detail.
Yeah. There you go. I was just going to ask you. So, how do they sound? What about the cost? I mean, are they affordable or?
Yeah. So these are $100 headphones.
Okay.
They're very reasonably priced as far as headphones go. There are certainly some that get considerably more expensive, and there are some, you know, sound quality improvements when you kind of pass that $150 mark. But I've always had a personal issue with spending more than $150 on headphones.
Mm-hmm.
So when I go to recommend headphones, I typically am recommending based on what I would personally be willing to spend. And so these, you know, these kind of, they fit that comfort zone as far as being comfortable enough to take with me anywhere. They collapse very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. They just, they sound nice. They're a little on the bass side. They're a little bass heavy. If that's not an attractive feature to you, then you may want to hear them before committing.
Oh, bass is in the tone, the bass tone, the tones.
Right.
Okay. All right. Why is that? I mean, is that something they might be working on, or that's just... No.
So it's not, it's directly considered a feature. The owner of the company is a big fan of bass heavy headphones.
So okay.
That was a feature as far as they were concerned.
Cost?
Yeah. So they're $99 right now.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about
they're,
that.
They're a very limited release. Like, you're not going to find them in Best Buy or places like that. You go to directly to their website to order right now, and they're expected to, you know, have them on Amazon within the next little while. But they are available to purchase right now, and you can actually get them to give as a gift before Christmas.
That's the Mod 1 Modular Headphone. Listeners, if you have a question about holiday tech gifts, give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's our annual gift guide with Russell Holly. We have an email question from Annette. She says, my 53-year-old son, who is very disabled with multiple sclerosis, would like to receive a virtual reality system for Christmas. However, he is confined to a motorized wheelchair and his disease limits his use of left hand and eye hand and hand-eye coordination. So he cannot use controllers requiring two hands. His right hand is fine, but operating a complex system may confuse him. If virtual reality systems could allow him to explore another place rather than play a game, it might be enjoyable. Is there a quality VR system that would be suitable for my son with his limitations?
Well, my immediate response would be to look at a mobile virtual reality headset because they have a single controller instead of two controllers. So it may end up being easier to navigate things like that. A lot of those systems can also be voice activated. The one that I would recommend, unfortunately, doesn't actually come out until very early next year. It's called the Oculus Go. And the reason I recommend that is it doesn't require a lot of, setup. Doesn't require, putting a phone into a headset each time and setting it up and making sure that it works correctly. It's just designed to be this kind of portable standalone thing with voice activated controls. If that's something that is appealing to this user instead of trying to worry about hand-eye coordination. If you wanted something right this second and you had one of the newer Samsung phones, then the Samsung Gear VR would do all of these things. But if you wanted something that was a standalone headset that this person would be able to enjoy, with a single controller, I would wait until after the holidays and look into the Oculus Go headset.
Oculus Go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hope that helped, Annette. What about virtual reality systems in general as a gift? I know you're a big fan of them, but what advice would you give someone who's interested in trying them out for the first time as a gift?
If they're already a big gamer they're already a big fan of the PlayStation, there are just more incredible games coming out all the time for PlayStation VR. If they have a little more room to play with or they have a PC that's a little more, built to handle things like complex gaming or things like that, then I would recommend the HTC Vive just because it, gives you a lot more flexibility as far as being able to walk around in a room and feel more immersed. But definitely those two are the pretty popular options this year.
Okay. Let's see. Laura in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a drone that could be given to a family. So kind of a beginner drone. I have children that have young children under 10. And I think the drone would be a fun thing, but I don't want to give it to any one child. I'd like to give it as a family gift so the parents themselves can make sure that the kids know how to use it and see what it's capable of and take the care they need to mm-hmm. with something like that. Is there anything around $100, $150?
Russell?
Well, if you're looking for something, to have something that would be, kind of family and very easy to start off with. The thing that I would look into would probably be the drones that were made earlier this year. They're actually Star Wars themed, oddly enough. They are made by Propel. You can find them in most Best Buy stores. It's the Propel drones. They actually come with a really incredible set of instructions for learning how to fly them and a very kid-friendly environment. They actually have a tutorial system that's built to teach how to fly the drone before you actually turn the drone on, using this kind of mini game that plugs into a phone. And they look pretty cool. They're smaller, so you can fly them in kind of low areas, and they should fit that price range pretty well.
Did you say Propel?
Yeah, the Propel Star Wars drones.
Okay,
would be Propel. The ones that I would initially look at.
So Propel, Propel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great, Laura. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Another gift idea you have for gamers is a laptop called the Razer Blade. We've talked about this before. Remind us what it's about and why it's good for gaming.
Yeah, so Razer has all of their products. Their whole company philosophy is that they're built for gaming. And sometimes they get a little silly with it.
Hey, Russell, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Russell, but you're sounding very fuzzy.
I'm very fuzzy.
Now you're not.
Well, I haven't done anything.
It's a little better.
Okay.
Okay, that's a lot better. Weird.
All right.
Okay.
So,
sorry.
The Razer Blade laptop. No, it's fine. The Razer Blade laptop. The whole function behind these machines is to cram as much power as possible into these laptops without making them giant. A lot of people think about gaming laptops and they're these kind of massive things that barely fit in backpacks. These are designed specifically to really look like matte black versions of MacBooks. They're very thin. They're very capable. The batteries will often last much longer than you would expect given the hardware that's inside of them. But you are definitely paying for the privilege. The Razer Blade laptop, the 14-inch version of this machine has everything that you would need to actually drive a virtual reality headset, which is kind of crazy when you think about how small it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a 4K display in it and will run any game for the next 2 years without a problem at very, very high settings. But they start at about $2,000.
Oof, okay. That's for that very special person on your Christmas list. Just a general, you wanted to talk about a pair of heated battery-powered gloves, the Versio heated gloves. Do tell.
Yeah, so I ran into this really fascinating problem this year. This is the first time in my entire life where the winter has started to come and like my feet and hands, I haven't been able to keep them warm at all. And it's been driving me insane. So I started looking for solutions outside of just kind of normal thermal gloves go as a, and it's not even started snowing here yet. Maryland is not as cold as it is in other places in the U.S. right now, so I'm a little concerned about what happens when it starts snowing here.
Yeah.
So I started looking for gloves that would be able to handle that, and absurdly came across these gloves on Amazon that are battery powered. They have separate batteries that plug into each one of the gloves and have three different heating levels. That will offer you varying levels of comfort depending on what it is that you need at the time, and it's 100% overkill for what it is that I'm probably ever going to need. But it was a solution to a very unusual problem for me.
Well, I hope that it works for you going forward into what is supposed to be a pretty nippy winter.
Yeah, I'm hoping that these solve that problem. Otherwise, I'm probably just going to live indoors, and that's going to make me sad because I usually like being outside when it snows.
Exactly. Russell, thank you for your ideas. We can maybe talk about some more next week. And thanks for your time today, as always.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for your questions. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.